Washington.
He's got his own title.
So, first of all, I'd like to mention that Connie Harrington got listed as the first author, but she is a very important co-author in this particular study. I'm going to talk about the Pacific Northwest in general, and particularly some empirical studies we've had that could be used to estimate the potential for bioenergy production. If we look at, Dale had an interesting evaluation previously of, they were looking at the possibility of providing about four quadrillion BTUs of energy to the U.S. economy from the standpoint of biomass. And this is the current production of energy, of sustainable energy in these bars, against a U.S. current, pretty close to current, use of about 100 quadrillion BTUs. So we're talking about close to 3%, and Dale's goal, I think they said, was 4. So we're nearly there. Now, the kind of energy that's produced is very different. Hydro, of course, is a sustainable, we're taking out our hydro dams in the Pacific Northwest, but some would say renewable. Biomass is actually currently a little bit more than that. A lot of this isn't producing an extremely high-value product like electricity, but is process heat in pulp and paper mills, and heat in homes like pellets and fuel wood and so on. Some of it is used to produce hydroelectric electricity as well. And then the other renewable sources are currently tiny. If you drive through the Midwest, you'd think that our entire economy is fueled by wind power, but it's a tiny drop in the bucket, and it will remain so way into the future, although it can be important. A number of studies, Dale mentioned the billion-ton biomass, or currently the 1.4 billion-ton biomass reports. The initial one in 2005, a draft in 2009, and then the current one just came out recently in August. And I know Tom Fox was involved in that. Maybe some of the rest of you were as well in producing that report. And it's focusing on the potential availability and current availability of biomass for any number of uses, but including bioenergy and as a chemical feedstock. For instance, the first polymer that was produced industrially was produced from cellulose. It was called rayon. And we've gone pretty much to an oil economy since then and gone away from the wood as a feedstock material. This shows the potential, the current and then the potential supply of materials. And I won't focus on all the different specifics, but one of the keys is forests provide a potential increase in the future in the availability of biomass feedstocks, whereas agriculture doesn't provide nearly as large a potential increase. So if we break down the agriculture here and the forest potential, according to the billion-ton biomass report, we find that with development in a few decades, forest sources could provide about twice as much as agriculture increases in biomass feedstocks. So forests are clearly an important part of any biomass future and are likely to be increasingly important in comparison to things like corn and ag materials in the future, although those are a big part as well. In the Pacific Northwest in specific, we have some major biomass resources that could be used and currently really aren't being used. For instance, this is a west side. It's been harvested. The logs have been moved off the site. And then this is the material that's left over. It's an enormous amount of organic material per acre. And we've got millions of acres of this going on per year. A lot of times this is piled and burned. It's rarely utilized. It's a big problem with seedling regeneration in our most intensive grow, harvest, prepare, and plant kind of forestry. Here's an example of the kind of, in this case, the logs are being moved to a landing, you can see an enormous amount of biomass. Also, Dale mentioned the possibility of a problem of catastrophic wildfires. In our drier east side forests, the productivity is not nearly so high, But there's an added problem in that this material provides and actually creates a situation where we have catastrophic wildfire. That's also potentially a fuel resource. In this case, they're collecting this material as part of a school. They're substituting wood and for natural gas and oil and heating schools in eastern Washington. Here's the kind of quaint kind of harvest and movement of the material off the site. And you can see this stand's now been treated for fuel reduction. And the possibility of catastrophic wildfire is almost eliminated in these stands, at least from the standpoint of fires that then move through these versus what this stand used to look like. So these can also become a biomass resource. And this doesn't involve reducing air production of wood and plywood at all. In fact, it's an additional resource. Here, for instance, this was a pile to see how much material you could actually take off of that. So it was accumulated and then measured and weighed. And we have one example in a locally very important, but in a national energy kind of picture, fairly small resource. This is the Kettle Falls, Washington biomass to electricity plant. It converts forest residues, not as part of normal forest harvesting. The kind of material we just saw is brought to this plant and then burned and is used to produce electricity in a region. Competitively in a region where hydropower is about 80% of the total, this produces and sustains a local economy in Kettle Falls and produces electricity at a very competitive rate. They've had trouble expanding. They've had a lot of trouble getting permits to expand. And then they also have a limited availability of material, so that their expansion was actually adding on natural gas rather than more wood capacity. Expanding wood capacity has proved to be a multi-tiered problem. And that's probably exemplified and demonstrated better than any other situation with the recent Duke Energy proposal a couple of years ago. I started getting involved in a soil sustainability evaluation of a 55 megawatt biomass to electricity plant that was going to go in near Shelton. And it was amazing to see the initial positive reaction, and then over time the public opposition that developed, which became extremely political, and resulting in a couple years later, also with the downturn in our economy, of Duke just saying it's not worth it. We're not going to fight and put this in a place where people don't want it. Also, they pointed out that with the downturn in the economy, the added electricity wasn't needed as much as they thought it would have been a few years earlier. And also that the subsidies, it looked like they might not be there like they thought they were going to be. As well, the Department of Natural Resources and the Forest Service kind of said, well, we have most of the land in the region and you can't count on us to supply anything to you in the way of biomass. So that kind of killed what would have been another major bioenergy to electricity plant in the region. It's still on hold. It still may come back, particularly if the economy upturns and they can get the subsidies, which are almost always currently a part of biomass bioenergy projects. We recently, in the Pacific Northwest, we had a major coup. We got the USDA said they're the largest projects they've ever funded, and both of them in Washington, $40 million projects for biofuels. And I'm part of the WSU project. The UW project, which is the office is right down, they're focusing on hybrid poplars. And I'm focused almost entirely on Douglas fir and coniferous forest production. So WSU is considering a multi-tiered approach at fuel availability. Everything from, well, hybrid poplar plantations are part of it, but we've got millions and millions of acres of Douglas fir, and I think we've got a total, at least in Washington, of a few tens of thousands of acres of poplar currently. That could change. But everything from our current forests, particularly the residues in those, down to things like garbage that could be used as a biofuel. So this is pretty exciting because we're trying to make a very high-value strategic material. It can be done, and it is being done, but not on a commercial basis. So turning woody materials into jet fuel. Okay, there's a number of breakthroughs that are going to happen, but that is the purpose of research. It reminds me in a lot of ways, Dale, about the integrated forest study that I used to be involved in, where you have so many scientists coming together and working on a common problem. The three meetings that we've already had were really exciting from that standpoint. This okay is also from the billion-ton biomass, and this shows on a national scale economically how much of this kind of a resource, logging residues and forest thinnings, might be available. The total resource is very large, but when you start looking at it from the standpoint of some assumptions that are made regarding sustainability, and assumptions generally without fertilization, which is hard to understand, and then the prices, less than $20, the resource is much, much smaller, but at $80 a ton dry weight, the resource is actually pretty close to the total resource that would be available. But not in an economic way. A lot of assumptions went into these kind of models, and they may change dramatically with time, particularly the assumption about how much it costs to harvest, how much it costs to transport, and so on. In the Pacific Northwest, Washington and Oregon, Oregon is the number one state to supply softwood lumber to the United States, about 4.5 to 5 billion board feet in good times. And Washington's number two at about 3.5 to 4 billion board feet or so when the economy's up. But when it comes to producing woody material at $80 per dry ton, which is a pretty high price, we fall below Georgia. So Larry Morris can be proud, and also Missouri, so Jeff Hatton can be proud of his state as well. They're number one and number two. This is mainly an economy of providing the material issue. It's less expensive in the Southeast. But the Pacific Northwest would be very, very important in providing an economical source of the raw material to an economy. I don't know, you can pick out where your state fits in that, but it pretty much follows forest productivity and the production of lumber and things as well. In the case of Washington State, I sometimes have a little trouble finding material and estimates for different parts of the Pacific Northwest. Washington has had a major study to estimate how much biomass would be available, and forestry comes out by far the largest source of potential biomass for bioenergy, by far. And this would be expressed in biomass and dry tons or energy within that biomass. So this energy could be utilized to produce electricity, it could be utilized to produce process heat, or it could also potentially, some of this could be a raw material that could produce bioproducts, like hopefully things like jet fuel with development. Agricultural residues, other waste materials, municipal solid waste can be a pretty big material, and that's one of the reasons why the Washington State project that I'm involved with in is looking at waste materials as potential sources of raw material for biofuels. In terms of what we need in these studies, well, we need to know the impact on soil. And with all the work that's been done by Dale and others, I just summarize this from Powers. We need to focus on organic matter, maintenance, the amount of organic matter and maintaining that in the soil. And to a certain extent, nutrients follow this, but certainly there are a lot of exceptions. But this is something that we can affect with our harvest. Also on soil physical properties, particular porosity. Running heavy equipment over can change that quickly. So there have been a number of studies. The Long-Term Soil Productivity Network, is Andy here? He's the current organizer of that. But it ranges over the major forest production regions of the U.S. and up into Canada. And the Fall River, Matlock, and Malawa studies that I'm going to talk about are affiliate sites of this larger project. And these focus on All of them have elements of organic matter removal intensities and also, in some cases, soil compaction. I've worked a lot more with Fall River, Matlock, and Malala than any of the others, particularly Fall River. And Fall River was meant in our region to represent the high site, Malala, a medium productivity site, and Matlock, it's a very coarse outwash soil, a low productivity site. As it turns out, these are similar because of other reasons, not because of soils, but because of rainfall and altitude and aspect. They've been similar in the previous stands productivity. Here's an example of the residue. Here's a site that had a bowl-only harvest, and then here's one that had a total above ground, often called a whole tree harvest, with the removal of coarse material down, including old growth logs, down to 1 centimeter. And so what we want to do is empirically see the impact that has on future productivity and also look for various processes. We can think of this material as going into biofuel. It's not currently utilized at all, except that it might provide habitat and future nutrients, but it definitely often provides a problem physically in terms of planting new trees in many of our sites because there's so much of it. So then that new plantation would become a sink for CO2, and would need to uptake nutrients from the site. And this is one of the major questions we would have regarding the removal of that material. Here's what the treatments would look like, ranging from a bowl-only harvest up to a much more intensive removal of organic material. You can see the loss of coarse material. And if we look at the budget, in this case of the Fall River site, we see that there's an enormous amount of material in the live trees, but there's also biomass, carbon, and also nitrogen and other material that could potentially become the biofuel, the biomass that we remove as a biofuel. On the other hand, at Fall River, the soil is the big pool of organic matter, carbon, and particularly of, in this case, nitrogen. We could have evaluated other nutrients, but nitrogen is the major nutrient-limiting productivity in these regions. Looking more closely at the trees, again, the bollwood represents the bulk of the biomass, but not necessarily the bulk of the nutrients. Foliage is a much tinier pool, but it's a fairly high percentage of nitrogen in this case. The Matlock and Malala studies didn't have all the same treatments, but in all cases, we had a fairly common harvest of bowl only, and then a total tree, and then in the Matlock and Malawa, they all had with and without vegetation control. We don't always have to practice that in the Pacific Northwest. It's often not done to a large extent, but the question is whether or not that would be as important in increasing productivity as it's been shown to be in other parts of the world. The treatments had major impacts on resultant organic matter laying on the ground. So coarse woody debris, 60 down to 2 tons. And then things that you wouldn't expect to change much. It's very hard to remove old stumps. It's very hard to remove new stumps. But old growth logs were picked up on that Total Tree Plus site. This might be a disaster in terms of habitat. That wasn't what we were studying. What we were studying is the growth of the new trees. And here's the treatment impacts at Matlock and Malawa. Again, a fairly big hit on coarse material, but not as high as with that Total Tree Plus. We didn't have that at Matlock and Malawa. So key findings, the removal of soil, first on soil compaction, we didn't see any big effects in these sites. In fact, we saw some positive impact on the growth of seedlings. In the national studies, they range from no effect. Generally, a positive effect of taking macropores, excess macropores, and turning some of them into micropores, which could hold water, down to some negative effects, particularly in fine textured soils. So soil compaction didn't seem to be a big negative impact at Fall River. In fact, quite the opposite. The only impacts we saw were positive. Whether or not that held out over time, we don't know. Findings in terms of biomass removal, we didn't see any real large impacts. The amount of biomass we took off had an insignificant effect on the future growth. We did see a big impact of vegetation management. Competing vegetation, when it was suppressed, had a major impact on the growth of the new trees. We can see that here for the first few years of growth. These are the different colors are the different removals of biomass. Matlock, not a big, oh, this is survival, not a big impact. Malawis, some but not a consistent one. Fall River, no impact at all. Here for the height, no real impact of the higher rates of organic matter on the growth of the new stand. These are young trees, and this we want to see whether this holds up in the future. In this case, the stem diameter at the ground also, no really big impact of the removal rates of organic matter. The big impact we saw was where we suppressed, in this case, we suppressed competing vegetation compared to no vegetation control. That always had an impact, including at Fall River, weeded, not weeded here. You can see the organic removal levels fall on top of each other. This is a five-year comparison, which was just published in Forest Ecology and Management, I think. So you can go look at it if you want. It's a neat study. Warren Devine put this together. And what we see is the impact of vegetation control. Without vegetation control, without Matlock, Malawa, and Fall River were all consistent on the growth of the trees. The only place where we had more total organic matter was at Malawa when we add the sum of the weeds, I guess, in the trees. We wanted to do an evaluation of what we think would be the impact of harvesting. And so one of the things we used was the Evans 1999 approach, where we look at the amount of a nutrient we remove with our harvest or lose as the result of leaching or whatever in comparison to the total ecosystem pool from the standpoint of the potential to knock down the productivity. Evans said 10% or less would be little chance of the total ecosystem. 30% might result in a serious impact, potentially. And then any time you remove half or more of the nutrient with a biomass harvest, you're likely, at least if that nutrient's limiting, you're likely to have an impact. We did an increasing evaluation, in this case at Fall River. The bowl only would result in about 2% removal. We start adding the total tree about 4%, stumps, snags, picking up material off the ground, all the way down to 0.1 removal. The roots were still less than that 10% or 0.1 impact where we would have the possibility of decline associated with nutrients. In the case of the Matlock tree, when we removed more of the material, it had a much larger impact on that pool, in this case 16%, or 0.16 of the fraction, compared to the Fall River of about 0.09. And remember, this removes all of the coarse material down to 1 centimeter and also removes the dead and down logs. So that's just what we would consider a very extreme case. And we didn't see that had an impact on productivity at all at Fall River or at Matlock. Just for a quick look at what the region might look like, the Fall River study's been a cost of several million total. We by the way, we're thanking CASI a lot for supporting this all along the way. We have the Matlock and Malawa. You could add several million more dollars in terms of the cost. These studies aren't spread all over the Pacific Northwest, but this is a fertilization study that Kim Litke and Austin Himes. Austin had his poster yesterday. Kim will have it tomorrow. And they evaluated the soil pool of nutrients. So from the top down to a meter. And here are the nitrogen contents of those ecosystems, which range from northern Vancouver Island through the coast all the way down into southern Oregon. And the nutrient, the nitrogen in those ranges from 300 kilograms, which is, of course, a very poor site, up to close to 30,000 kilograms of nitrogen, which is an enormous nitrogen pool on site. Interestingly enough, Kim's finding that some of these sites, you should go to the poster tomorrow, actually can respond to nitrogen, even though what we're doing here is not evaluating whether or not they would respond with this evaluation, but whether or not that would be a big hit on the nutrient pool that's on the site. But The more you study nitrogen in particular, or probably any other nutrient, the more you realize you don't know. And I think that's been often cited as the sign of true wisdom, as when you get really, really smart about something, but what you realize that there's the more you learn, the more there is to learn. So we're really excited about these studies in terms not only of the maintenance of and sustainability of the production of our forests, but also the potential for increasing that. Okay? And with that, I just want to say we have some quick recommendations. We would always want to retain and protect the forest floor. We would always want to retain and protect NEA horizon. But when it comes to wood removal, we need to evaluate it from the standpoint of nutrient pools. Okay? And coarse woody material, although that doesn't seem to hold up as an important thing for the seedling growth, that, of course, is a habitat thing. There's a lot of other issues than just whether or not your new trees will grow fast. So that wasn't the point of my evaluation. And I want to thank a large number of entities for supporting these studies over a period of more than a decade now, and hopefully for decades in the future. Particularly, I'd like to thank Eric Vance, who's also going to be an author here, and for the future, our Northwest Aviation Renewables Alliance, which will be funding these studies a bit as well in the future. So thank you.
Got time for a couple questions for Rob?
Well, I wouldn't say that public opinion turned. There was still a lot of support for the project, and there still is, particularly in a place like Shelton. But what we have in the Pacific Northwest is we have a lot of people that have moved into the region because it's such a beautiful, including me, because it's such a beautiful, wonderful area, and they don't want anything to change at all. And in particular, industry isn't... appreciated. But the bulk of the people who seem to be more quiet about things are more interested in jobs, the availability of energy, and so on. I think the real impact that had an they don't want to fight public opinion, obviously, but they had it. It went both ways. The real, I think, the real issue was the availability of biomass. And when most of your land is federal and state, and they say they aren't going to help you, I think. You know, in the Pacific Northwest, the Forest Service has just stopped being an important player in the availability of wood. Last year, in previous years, the industry provided something like 9 billion board feet of I know mostly about timber, billion board feet of timber. Oregon's number one, Washington's number two. Our national forest system for the whole region, which is almost as much land, produced 0.1 billion board feet. So we have to have federal lands be players in this bioenergy, and the studies show that, but when it comes down to actually going in and cutting wood off of them, it seems to be a different story. And by the way, we, on the average, import about 16 billion board feet from Canada. So we are where we were in the 70s with timber, although a very friendly neighbor, fortunately, where we were in the oil with oil in the 70s. We are not providing our own, at least in an up economy, our own timber needs. We're relying on importation, fortunately from Canada, mostly.
We're cool with that.
Canada's cool with that. But we have to come up with some mechanism where we have a better supply. We have the supply there. We evaluate it. It's there. But when it comes to actually using it, it's very tough, particularly on federal lands and also on state lands.
Rob, is there much use of sludge in
forests? All sludge is utilized. Every drop of sludge in the Pacific Northwest is utilized for land application of one source or another. If we take Seattle as an example, a third of Seattle biosolids is the term they like to use, but a third of Seattle biosolids or sludge is applied to agriculture, and this is on purpose. It could all be applied to forestry very easily. About a third of it is used to produce compost, which is sold mostly in commercial markets. And about a third is applied to forestry in regions closer to Seattle. And that goes with cities like Tacoma and Portland and so on, too. They're all land applied, they're all utilized, and they're not important. They're locally extremely important on an acre, but when you build it up as a resource, we just don't have enough to have a big impact on wood production and also bioenergy. But it absolutely should be land utilized within certain safeguards, and it absolutely currently is. I would say that biosolids is somewhat, it's a great funding source, but it's somewhat of a non-issue in terms of the overall bioenergy. There's just not that much of it.